Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, December 30th, 2004. Today's session is entitled Gandhi and Nonviolence, led by David Scott. Session number SCD-2004-01. Let's listen in.
It says 7 o'clock, and I gather, since there was a request to push the time up a little bit, that we'd like to leave a little bit earlier than otherwise. I wonder if it might be helpful for all of us if we just went around the group and said our name and then said something of some contact you may have had with Gandhi's life or his ideas or his vision that we're going to be talking about. Many of you may have seen Attenborough's film, Gandhi. Others of you may have read something from his My Experiments with Truth. Whatever it is, it might be helpful for all of us to sort of get to know where we are and what we're doing. Who would like to begin? Okay, you want to be back there?
Yeah, I'm Bob. And I've read a lot about Gandhi. Read, I think, some of his experiments with truth and Erickson's kind of study of him, and seen the movie. And he's always been a real inspiration.
Okay, good.
And I'm Lars, and similar reading and been very influential.
Okay.
I'm Angie. I know pretty much nothing about Gandhi other than the main things, basics that everyone knows. And so.
Which are? Okay.
You know, it's just
yeah, that much,
nonviolence, he stood for peace, and did a lot of really good things for India, and that's what I know, and so
okay.
I want to know more.
I'm Janet, and I saw the movie many, many years ago, but I remember, one of the things I remember is this walk to the sea.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm Mike, and I learned a few things from I forgot her name already.
Angie.
So that's where I'm at.
My name's Terry, and I'm intrigued by his early life as a lawyer.
Okay. And I'm Stan, and I've just known him for his piece, and very little about him, but I'd like to learn a little bit more.
Okay.
So. I'm Dale, and I'm old enough that I remember when he was. This nonviolent and so influential in India becoming an independent state, but I've read a little, but I remember seeing the movie.
I know nothing. Oh, Sigmora.
I'm Greg, and all I know is that he was into the peace thing.
Okay.
My name is Jim, and my knowledge of Gandhi is pretty superficial. What I do know, I probably acquired at various times at Holden, but I've always been interested in his late life efforts to prevent the conflict between the Pakistanis and the Indians.
Okay.
And I'm Sue, and I saw the film.
Okay, good.
My name is David, and I have just a superficial knowledge of Gandhi.
All right.
My name is Tom, and I certainly appreciate Gandhi, but I was aware also of the work called Past Imperfect that talks about history, how imperfect history has been presented through film and popular publications, and the discussion of a lot of Gandhi's dark side.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm Anita, and I remember when he was assassinated.
Okay.
I was a youngster. I'm thinking probably 6 or 7 or so is what I'm remembering, and it affected me deeply that somebody would have assassinated him and killed him, and I had a hard time understanding why that would be the case for somebody that was, and from my perspective as this youngster, trying to do good things.
Okay, good. Yeah. Back there in the middle row. In the middle row there, yeah.
Oh, here?
Yeah. Oh, you already spoke, sorry.
I'm Bob, and I remember the newsreels as a child. Only time you ever saw news is you went to the movie and they had the newsreels. And he was featured a great deal in the newsreels at that time. Mm. People saw him, and that was my impression.
Right.
And I'm Sonia, and I've also seen the movie and done a little bit of studying on my own, but fairly superficial understanding.
Good. Up in the balcony.
I'm Scott. I've tried to study on a few times, haven't found any good sources. I know a little bit.
Okay. Friends who have just come in, we're saying our name and any of contact or any experience or, you know, the film or reading about Gandhi or anything?
Pat from Lake Forest Park. And, you know, primarily just reading of books.
Okay.
I'm Jane from Seattle, and I do need to see the film.
I'm Glenn from Colfax, and I guess mostly during college, maybe some graduate school, I read quite a bit of Gandhi, at least English stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. What I thought I would do this evening. Oh, I beg your pardon. A couple more back here. Yeah, Hans.
I've just seen at least one documentary on Gandhi, and I haven't read anything by him, but have read some read writings by Aidan Ballou, who was an American pacifist who was a big influence on Tolstoy, who was an influence on Gandhi, who was, and then I've read some work by Martin Luther King Jr., who of course is a very, very devoted was heavily influenced by Gandhi.
Carol from Colfax, and I knew stuff about Gandhi, but I mean, not well read.
I'm Carl, and basically same as him, except I haven't seen the documentary on him.
Okay. Somebody came in the back row there.
We're
saying our name and any sort of contact or anything about Gandhi, read something of his or saw a film or something?
I did a report in 7th grade.
I'm Catherine, and remember seeing the movie, being very impacted by it. I feel like I've revisited Gandhi just because I'm really interested in nonviolence and the various movements that have sprung up.
Awesome.
I remember as a little kid seeing and hearing about him in the papers and in the news, and saw the movie, Gandhi.
Okay, good. And our friend who just came in over there.
Hi, Jim.
We're saying our name and anything we know about Gandhi or any experience we've had or anything.
Yeah, I mean, I also, as I've said, I saw the famous Gandhi movie and was really moved by that. And I've read a bit about his life and those kinds of things.
Okay, does that take care of everybody? Yes, sorry.
Anita and
beg your pardon.
Oh, that's okay. I've seen the film and some college courses. So it was. But I came in a little late, and I know a lot of us did. Have you already introduced yourself, David?
I've not introduced myself.
Okay. I thought maybe I missed it.
I'm David, and I have spent my whole life in India, basically, and I've done academic studies in the history of religions and taught in several seminaries in India in that field. My specialty is the Hindu religious tradition. I first came into contact with Gandhi through an ashram, one of his ashrams about which we're going to speak, named Sevagram, which was very close to where my family was living in Nagpur in central India at that time. And upon occasion, I have been at the ashram and spent time. And also, particularly, Gandhi was well known for his evening prayer services, which were very interreligious and very scriptures from all of the major religions were read, hymns were sung from the various traditions and so on. It was a very moving kind of experience, and in a way that's what got me sort of started in this, in my whole interest in religions, and particularly as the Christian faith relates to other religious traditions, as was a major question in the seminary, obviously, where I taught. And as you know, if there is any place in the world that is characterized by religious diversity, it certainly is India, with at least three or four of the major religious traditions of the world taking root and developing on that subcontinent. And so I come to you today as one who has done a fair amount of reading and some personal experience. I might say that most recently, Corinne and I were in South Africa, and my appetite was again whetted, an interest in Gandhi, particularly since most studies of Gandhi really don't give sufficient importance, I think, to Gandhi's experience in South Africa. Those were very, very formative years for him. And in a way, as I will mention in a little bit, what developed in Gandhi in South Africa later came to a fuller blossoming in India. And so in a very real way, Gandhi's roots are not only in India, but also very much in South Africa and the South African experience. And that has become more clear to me in recent days after our time in South Africa. What I would like to do is to begin by asking Corinne if she would read us several quotations from Gandhi, just to put us in a frame of mind and context for our consideration of Gandhi.
These several quotations were put together by Richard Attenborough, and it's interesting to just read the introduction to this book, this brief combination of quotations from Gandhi, to find out how deeply Attenborough himself was impacted by Gandhi, and after his decision to make the film, that he said that it had been one of the most deep experiences of his life, and it was a 20-year pursuit before he made the film. Yeah. So it's quite extraordinary to realize, and he said every other major decision of his life has been influenced by that whole process. So I was going to read two quotations, which I think give some insight into Gandhi's experience and Gandhi's approach. This one from the section on nonviolence. He says, "I am not a visionary. I claim to be a practical idealist. The religion of nonviolence is not meant merely for the rishis and saints. It is meant for the common people as well. Nonviolence is the law of our species, as violence is the law of the brute. The spirit lies dormant in the brute, and he knows no law but that of physical might. The dignity of man requires obedience to a higher law, to the strength of the spirit. I have therefore ventured to place before India the ancient law of self-sacrifice. For satyagraha, or truth force, and its offshoots, non-cooperation and civil resistance, are nothing but new names for the law of suffering. the rishis realized their, the rishis taught a weary world that its salvation lay not through violence, but through nonviolence. Nonviolence is its dynamic, in its dynamic condition, means conscious suffering. It does not mean meek submission to the will of the evildoer, but it means the pitting of one's whole soul against the will of the tyrant. Working under this law of our being, it is possible for a single individual to defy the whole might of an unjust empire to save his honor, his religion, his soul, and lay the foundation for that empire's fall or its regeneration. And for Gandhi, the link between religion and practice, religion and nonviolence, religion and politics, is very central. And this is a quotation from the section on faith. To see the universal and all-pervading spirit of truth face to face, one must be able to love the meanest of creation as oneself. And a man who aspires after that cannot afford to keep out of any field of life. That is why my devotion to truth has drawn me into the field of politics. And I can say without the slightest hesitation, and yet in all humility, that those who say that religion has nothing to do with politics do not know what religion means.
Prince, I have a confession to make to you, and that is that I'm feeling a little under the pressure of time tonight. There is so much that I would like to say, and as many of you may know or suspect, one of the sort of occupational diseases of teachers can be verbal diarrhea, and I don't want to get into an endless harangue tonight. So I'm going to follow my notes a little more closely than I would ordinarily do, if you will pardon me. I think we will all benefit as a result. M.K. Gandhi, his name Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, came to be known as the Mahatma. And the word Mahatma in Sanskrit means the great soul, the Maha Atma, the great soul. And this great soul, whom we are going to look at very briefly this evening, has, as we would all recognize, I'm sure, been a towering Asian figure in the 20th century of our era. Gandhi has been one of the major inspirations in the world, in the whole search for peace and peaceful means of resolving conflict. And therefore, it seems to me very appropriate that we spend a little time having a look at Gandhi and his vision and its reality, particularly in the context of the retreat, the Way of Peace, in which we are engaged during this week. But before I begin some actual reflections on Gandhi, I would like to put what I'm going to say in the framework of an event that took place more recently than Gandhi. I refer to a December morning in 1992 when a dilapidated mosque in the North Indian town known as Ayodhya was razed to the ground. It was a violent action, an extremely violent action that was calculated to, as a defiant action of destruction by several hundred Hindu militant activists who were fired by a fierce hatred of Islam, of Muslims, and their hope that the destruction of the mosque, some of you may recognize it as the Babri Masjid, that the destruction of the mosque would provide for Hindu India a symbol of a recently newly revived Hindu India. Because the mosque, it was claimed, was built on top of the site where the birthplace of the Hindu deity Ram, who is an incarnation, a divine incarnation is supposed to have been born. And so the mosque then was an affront to the Hindus, or at least these Hindu militants, and they were bent on destroying it. And it was an incredible event, with people crawling all over it with sledgehammers and crowbars and just tearing the whole thing down within several hours. It was an amazing experience. And Corinne and I at that time found ourselves in a country that was engulfed by violence and fear and incomprehension. Many people just did not understand what was going on. More than 1,000 people had been killed in the process. Property and places of worship had been burned, and it was a time of utter violent chaos. And we found our Indian colleagues devastated, ashamed, nonplussed at the violence, because and added to that was the fact that it was barely disguised in the support that it received from the government as well as from the Hindu police force. So that is an indication of something that's been going on in this country of peace, in this country of the Mahatma. I think that it is true to say that that the general outline of Gandhi's life is probably well known, but let me just touch on a few of the more salient facts of his life. He was born, as indicated, in 1869 into a relatively middle-class family, in Hindu family in Western India. At the age of 19, sometime after the death of his father, he was sent to England to study law. It was quite common in those, well, fairly common in those days, for aspiring lawyers to go to India, to go to England and sit for the bar and come back to India. And it was expected that Gandhi would do the same, and that he would come back and take control or take care of his extended family's fortunes. However, Gandhi, when he returned, turned out to be a rather timid sort of fellow. And he lacked any powerful political patrons, and it led him into a time of failure, of realization of failure and frustration, from which he was rescued, actually, by the opportunity to go to South Africa and take up a job with an Indian firm that was trading in South Africa. He only went for 1 year with a contract, but he in fact stayed more than 20 years, and those years, as I have indicated to you, were extremely formative and important for him. And he then returned to India just at the beginning of World War I as a prosperous lawyer, a journalist, and a political activist on behalf of the Indian community in South Africa. Despite his South African experience, Gandhi initially there was no indication that Gandhi was somehow going to get involved in the freedom struggle with the Indian National Congress, the movement of Jawaharlal Nehru and so many others that were involved in the freedom struggle for India, for India's freedom. That finally happened actually in about 1919 when he became involved. One of the particular events that drew him into the whole conflict was his decision to challenge the British tax on salt. And you may remember from the film the vivid depiction of Gandhi leading a group of ragtag kind of followers marching down to the sea to dry the seawater and make salt as a symbolic gesture against the British imposition of a tax on salt, and of course salt being a very very crucial and critical element in people's diet, this was a major. Gandhi was a past master at symbolic gestures. I mean, he was a real he knew where people were and what would sort of touch them and attract them. Anyway, after that, he became very much involved in the freedom struggle and became, I would suggest, probably all would agree, one of the most significant but and yet very enigmatic of India's leaders until 1947, when India gained its independence, and finally when he was assassinated in January 1948. Ironically, of course, as you well know, his assassination was carried out by a Hindu militant activist who was totally opposed to Gandhi's interreligious sensitivities and willingness to see the concerns of all people, and Nathuram Godse just could not stand this and shot Gandhi in January of 1948. I think it is fair to say that Gandhi did not consider himself as a particularly unique individual. He saw himself very much as a person like other persons, with human frailties, with a potential for both good and ill, and this he struggled with a great deal. His own self-image was one of a person on pilgrimage, seeking the truth, struggling with the nature of truth, and the search for a right means for coping with life's problems and dilemmas. And as I've already indicated, and many of you know, he titled the partial autobiography of his The Story of My Experiments with Truth. I think it is significant for us to note that Gandhi refused to set any of his ideas in any kind of a religious sort of text that people could refer back to and say this is our text, if you will. In fact, Gandhi was very clear that there was no such thing as Gandhiism. Most of what he engaged himself in were experiments, as he called them, experiments with truth, dealing with specific situations in particular ways that he felt were appropriate at that time. He certainly was a man who was at odds with himself much of the time. continually fighting anger. He probably suffered from depression, I think all would agree. On several occasions, he worked himself up into such an emotional stress or stew that he literally made himself physically ill. And he was a very difficult person to get along with, as his wife and his close companions found out to their dismay. Near the end of his life, there were long periods of silence. I suspect that they were partly an attempt to deal with the turmoil that was going on within him, as well as possibly a mechanism to protect himself from the constant demands that were being placed on him near the end of his career. In the end, he seems to have seen his life as a failure. Certainly he believed that the India that he saw, the independence of India, India free from Britain, was an India that was torn apart by communal violence. And Gandhi was convinced that one of the causes of this was that India had never properly engaged in satyagraha, that India had never properly engaged in this grasping of truth, which is literally what satyagraha means, a Sanskrit word, satya meaning truth, and graha meaning to grasp a hold of or to hold on to tight. And so he was convinced that India had never really engaged in satyagraha. So friends, then we have a very human individual whose sensitivity of spirit and whose political experiments with truth are probably the more remarkable in view of his inner struggles, a man continually in struggle. Now, it seems to me that in order to understand properly or adequately what Gandhi was about and what he meant by satyagraha, is to immediately see that for him satyagraha was a way of life. This was not a sort of a strategy. This was not an isolated practice that one could engage in order to solve a particular problem. Satyagraha for Gandhi was an integral, overwhelming, inclusive vision of the meaning of life. What does life mean? What is it all about? We know from his writings that the central core of this understanding of satyagraha already had developed while he was still in South Africa, but he continued throughout his life to refine his understanding and his experimenting with truth right up until the end of his life. Because for him, satyagraha was embedded in a theological vision of reality and of humanity and of the meaning of human life and the creation around. Satyagraha, at its deepest level, was a vision, religious commitment, a matter of faith. So we are not here talking about a political stratagem or even a means of attaining a particular end, but rather this larger vision of what life is all about and what we are engaged in. Now, I don't want to spend much time discussing the sort of background of Gandhi's vision or the sources of it. Suffice it to say that he drew on two sort of primary groups of sources, Obviously, he drew on the Hindu tradition and on the Jain tradition. Don't think I wrote the word Jaina, J-A-I-N, another religious tradition in India, particularly prevalent in Western India, where he grew up. He also drew on Christian scripture. As you well know, the Sermon on the Mount was immensely important for Gandhi, and he continually quoted from it, as well as Western writings from people like Tolstoy and so on. What I would like to do very, very quickly is to suggest or to lay out three basic elements in Gandhi's vision of that which is truly real, and see how these three elements played themselves out in his life. In the first place, Gandhi believed, as did and do all Hindus, that the humankind, we human beings, are at one with all other beings. The Hindu concept, which is to be found in Hindu scriptures, of the Brahman, which is the cosmic soul, and its identity with the Atman, which is the individual soul. And so this identity of the individual soul with the cosmic soul is the sort of basis for Gandhi's understanding of that reality, that divinity, whatever you wish to call it, which undergirds and infuses all created life. And therefore, it behooves us to cherish and to respect all life. A second element here, and won't spend much time on it, is Gandhi's belief, as again with common to several of the Hindu, several of the Indian religious traditions, that every action that is performed by an individual has significant repercussions for good or ill on everything and everybody that is related to that particular person. So this understanding that actions have their reactions, and whether they are for good or for ill, there is this interlinking of action and reaction, which is again a part of the totality and the wholeness of life. The second element that I would hold up this evening is that Gandhi was both eclectic as well as tolerant in his vision of cosmic truth. Gandhi was profoundly influenced by the Jain religious tradition, which continues to teach that truth is many-sided, and they use the example of a diamond, and the diamond has different facets, and the diamond will look differently depending upon how you turn it or which facet you look at. And so the multifaceted character of truth is very much a part of that. And Gandhi was convinced that any individual can only know and understand one or maybe two facets of truth, never the whole of the truth. We are innocent of the totality of truth. We can never grasp the whole of the truth. And therefore, Gandhi had no time for religious orthodoxies which claimed that they had the truth and nobody else. In fact, Gandhi went so far as to suggest that there are as many religions in the world as there are individuals. I don't know whether one would go with that or not, but anyway, that gives an indication of his his experience and understanding of the diversity and the multifaceted nature of truth. And therefore, in any conflict, Gandhi would argue, no one party possesses the entire truth. No one party has a monopoly on truth. And so the way of resolving conflict must be found, which safeguards the integrity of all parties and allows the possibility of all parties to expand and deepen their vision of the truth so that we will know a little bit more about the truth, but never, unfortunately, be able to comprehend the entirety of truth. Finally, in this sort of second element of tolerance and his eclectic approach to the question of religious diversity, the unity of all being suggested to Gandhi that it is impossible to distinguish between ends or instruments or ways of achieving goals the means of achieving certain goals or ends. They are directly interrelated with one another, and Gandhi was convinced that a bad means can never produce a good end, because bad means produce evil in the process and contaminates, if you want to use that imagery, contaminates the final product. And you know, for instance, many of us feel that there is no way that democracy is going to be established in the Middle East by bombing the hell out of everybody. You know, I mean, if your means are not good, your end will also not be good. By the same token, Gandhi argued that good ends do produce good means, and so there is a direct relationship between end and means, which Gandhi used in his convincing of others to go along with him in many of his experiments with truth. As a result of this, Gandhi engaged supported and advocated the use of nonviolence. He frequently used the term ahimsa, which again is a combination of two Sanskrit words. Ah is the negative, and himsa means violence, and so it literally means, ahimsa literally means nonviolence. But I think it is important to realize that Gandhi's ideal of nonviolence was a radical departure or a radical expansion of the traditional, somewhat negative concept of abstaining from violence. This is not what Gandhi was talking about. Gandhi was, when he talked about nonviolence, was talking about a positive, outgoing compassion and concern for all life and everything that lives. And so his understanding of nonviolence was a more expansive one than the term nonviolence would tend to indicate. As a result of this, Gandhi felt that it was necessary to cultivate a particular lifestyle. And by creating a personal and a social context in which people could learn the basic attitude and stance of nonviolence and develop a quality as a part of their lives. Gandhi felt that nonviolence has to do with moral strength and fearlessness. Gandhi would deny that that satyagraha or ahimsa was a negative aspect. And the satyagraha was for the strong, those who are morally personally strong, and that passive resistance, on the other hand, was a weapon of the weak-hearted. So satyagraha was not something that was to be undertaken lightly or easily. Gandhi spent a great deal of time prior to every one of his campaigns of satyagraha preparing the people who were to engage in satyagraha so that they would be able to withstand the turmoil and the strife that would be result from that. So in practical terms, all of this led Gandhi to a drastic simplification of life. He advocated and himself did away with all but the bare minimum of possessions. He, as we all know, ate a very restricted vegetarian diet. He took a vow of celibacy that produced a number of what many people think were quite aberrational behavior patterns, but we won't talk about that this evening unless you want to. And by all of this, Gandhi saw himself as cutting the individual ties of affection and dependence, and this is something that is very difficult to accept for many, because he saw that these ties of affection and dependence were preventing him from serving a wider humanity, a larger family, and that to him was more important. Freedom from fear also was a very central aspect of his practice of satyagraha. Gandhi was convinced that many of us are fearful of our possessions, that we might lose them, fearful of our false honor, that we might lose it, fearful of our relatives, that we might lose them, fearful of government power, fearful of bodily injury, fearful of death. And it was a liberation from this fear, or a freedom from this fear, that Gandhi saw as central to his understanding of satyagraha. And thirdly, the third element in his pursuit of satyagraha is an interesting one, and one that is not stressed, I think, sufficiently, and that is that Gandhi was convinced that the way of life that he advocated, the style of life, could best be pursued and engaged in a series of communities on the lines of a Hindu ashram. And an ashram, as many of you know, is basically a disciplined, intentional community fostering and inculcating and supporting and encouraging certain aims and goals. Two of these ashrams were founded in South Africa, and two of the major ashrams the one in Ahmedabad in Western India, and the Sevagram that I've already mentioned, that was in Central India. And Gandhi felt that if he could solve India's problems in microcosm, in these ashrams, that he would then have a message for the entire country. That unless he was able to deal with the major problems of India in these intentional, disciplined communities, that he basically had nothing to say to the country as a whole. And so there were these ashram communities in which men and women lived a common religious life of simplicity and self-reliance. They were these communities were as self-sufficient as possible. Their members did their own work and performed their own menial tasks. They were dedicated to vows of truth and non-violence and celibacy and simplicity of diet and possession of bare essentials of life. These ashrams, of course, as one can well imagine, and one has already sort of known, I presume, attracted a rather motley crowd of both Indian as well as foreign devotees and hangers-on, and frequently they were the scene of petty scandals and squabbles. Yet Gandhi believed that he had to try to fashion a lifestyle where people could learn to live together in satyagraha, in truth, cultivating fearlessness, cultivating tolerance, cultivating equality, cultivating justice. And so he was convinced that only in the radical transformation of individuals was to be found the key to the new India, to the growth of true satyagraha. And so to Gandhi, these ashrams were more important to him in many ways than the politics and work which he carried out in the public arena, because he was because they were concerned with the transformation of individual lives, and this to Gandhi was extremely important. Along with the concern for the individual, along with the concern for small-scale communities, Gandhi also envisaged the development of a political and socioeconomic arrangement that would minimize levels of violence in relations between people and groups. A couple of examples, his abhorrence of industrialization is well known. But and Gandhi's reason was that he felt that industrialization, factories and factory production and so on, serve to increase consumerism and to make things available far beyond the actual needs of the human beings and cater to the wants and desires. He also felt that the relations between workers and owners were frequently marked by actual, if not potential, if not actual, violence. So he was much opposed to this whole business of industrialization. And he and, of course, Jawaharlal Nehru were very much at odds in this regard. Another area in which Gandhi had some interesting ideas is that rather than force the privileged and the rich to be dispossessed of their wealth and their resources, which Gandhi felt would lead to violence of some sort, Gandhi recommended the development of an attitude of what he called trusteeship. By this, Gandhi meant that people who had resources of any kind should understand themselves as trustees of those resources that they were holding in trust for their the poor and those who did not have those resources. So he felt that if the wealthy and the powerful would understand what they have as a trust being held and used for others, that would be a better solution rather than to ask them to divest themselves or to be physically divested of their wealth and resources. Gandhi also, as you probably are aware, had a very serious dislike of the modern state, whether it was colonial or whether it was independent. Partly, this arose out of his concern with power, and that he felt that the modern state is has great potential for organized violence, and he obviously was very much opposed to that. His ideal, actually, was a loose federation of small governing republics, which he believed people in a face-to-face relationship, where on that were that would allow them to express themselves, to be more caring and more tolerant of one another. Of course, whether or not face-to-face relationships are necessarily less violent is, I think, a matter open for discussion. But finally, I would like to suggest that it is important to observe that Gandhi's discussion about the circumstances that were most conducive to the cultivation of nonviolence actually had very little impact outside of his ashram communities. But they do underline, I think, and it is important, they do underline that for Gandhi, nonviolence was a way of life, not a strategy, not a tactic, not a temporary mode of handling conflict. So this, I think, is an important truth for us to be aware of. Gandhi, in fact, often spoke of endeavoring to discover the science of satyagraha. And he referred to certain conflicts in which he became involved as laboratories of nonviolence. However, he never produced, interestingly enough, any theory of nonviolence as a mode of coping with conflict. He never wrote any treatise on satyagraha, because much of what Gandhi did and said and wrote was truly experimental, a response to specific needs and opportunities for particular opportunities of particular situations. However, it is quite clear that for Gandhi, the forms of nonviolence resistance to wrong had in fact a very limited role in the total vision of his nonviolent society. For him, issues such as tolerance and harmony between religious groups, abolition of gross inequalities in society, particularly untouchability in the Indian caste system, and the practice of hand spinning. Again, another indication of one of Gandhi's symbolic actions, which caught the imagination of the Indian people in a very powerful way. Hand spinning, again, a rejection, if you will, of the factory mill-produced cloth that was coming from England and was being sold at good prices in India, and so as a symbol of countering this kind of activity. Gandhi engaged in hand spinning and also advocated the use of hand-spun cloth for clothes and other cloth needs in the country. And Gandhi felt that these things were more important than who was in power in the government. These were signs for him of true personal and social change. One of the clearest examples, and I will soon come to an end here, one of the clearest examples of his priorities occurred in 1941, when the full impact and import of World War II was becoming clear in India. At the time, there was a crisis in the country, and in the Indian National Congress, the group that was leading the struggle for independence, when they had to decide whether they would assist the British in the war effort or whether they would resist the Raj. Interestingly enough, at this time, Gandhi said nothing about either situation or either option, but rather wrote a pamphlet on his program for national reconstruction. He touched on communal harmony. He touched on the removal of untouchability. He touched on the need for prohibition. He touched on the importance of the production of hand-spun clothes. He touched on education. He touched on the role of women. He touched on urban and rural labor and so on. And this at a time when the rest of the country was caught up in this issue of whether to resist the British Raj and their efforts in the Second World War or not. So that he by this, I think, made it quite clear that in the total plan of renewal, civil disobedience actually had a rather small and restricted role. In fact, he concluded this pamphlet that he wrote, or this pamphlet, rather long, but pamphlet that he wrote, with the words, "For my handling of civil disobedience without a constructive program will be like a paralyzed hand attempting to lift a spoon." And in fact, paralyzed hand was more frequently seen trying to lift the spoon than not, as far as Gandhi was concerned. Gandhi, as I have already indicated, was deeply saddened by Indian independence. It was not, in his eyes, achieved by Satyagraha, and therefore it did not bring about any major moral changes in Indian attitudes or priorities. Indians, he felt, were merely stepping into the shoes of the British rulers. They were inheriting the many of the British assumptions and manners and their capacities for organized violence. What had passed for Satyagraha, as far as Gandhi was concerned, had not changed the dynamics of relations within India. Communal violence, the violence of religious groups against one another, had wrecked the unity of the country, and leaving thousands dead and injured and homeless. And socioeconomic conflicts were just barely close to the surface. So, friends, here seems to be little comfort for those of us who think Gandhi had easy answers or a blueprint for a more peaceful world. And I will ask Corinne now to...
Why don't you skip that? I think the time is going to...
I think time is too much. We don't have much time left, that's true. Well, what I would like to suggest, and maybe we could engage in this for some time, and this may lead us into other discussions. It seems to me that one of the issues that a consideration of Gandhi and his vision of Satyagraha leads us to is the whole question of personality formation and education. And I would wonder what isn't, given the fact that Gandhi was convinced that a non-violent activist or a satyagrahi is not made overnight, but created by a disciplined and consistent lifestyle. I would wonder, what are we doing in our families? What are we doing in our schools? What are we doing in our colleges and other places of nurture and education to create a freedom from the fears and the frustrations that so readily breed violence? Can we think of some examples of things that you know of that are being done in either in families or in schools or colleges or wherever, that help to free people from the fears and the frustrations that lie at the root of violence in our society? Or is this even a question that you think is an important one? I don't know. Yes?
I'm curious. I think that the scriptures, to a large extent, are helpful for people in this context, in this society, and in the Eastern scriptures. And I'm wondering with Gandhi, the guru-disciple relationship is so central there. I've never really understood if Gandhi had that relationship, what his relationship, for instance, with Buddha or Christ or the story that he was supposed to have had some interaction with Meher Baba, but they felt that he had put political responsibilities first, and that never happened. I'm wondering is if you can have this type of involvement in this intense of a political life without an equally intense connection to the spiritual disciplines that come from the different traditions and the lineages.
Yeah, I think Gandhi drew on his Hindu tradition. He was a Vaishnava, that is, he was a follower of Vishnu in the Hindu tradition. He also, of course, drew on the Jain tradition. Christian scripture. These were many of the. But I don't know that he would say that he had a sort of personal relationship, a guru-shishya relationship, with any one of these manifestations of deity or not. I don't think he really sort of thought in those terms. Don't know. I'm not aware of his ever saying that I have a personal guru shishya relationship with a particular the Buddha or Meher Baba or in any of that kind of thing. But I don't think it's because he was so engaged in political activity that he didn't have this kind of truth for him was this compelling quest that led him on, and he saw evidences of this truth in a number of different religious traditions, and that's why I presume in his nightly prayer meetings, scriptures from various religious traditions and the singing from songs from various religious traditions informed both Gandhi and as well as the ashram community.
In terms of examples, and I haven't seen it, but I've heard about it, mm-hmm. where in schools, grade school perhaps, when children have some sort of conflict, you know, like one student with another, there's a conflict resolution method, you know, mm-hmm. there's some other students mm-hmm. who will listen to events, you know, and have a little counsel about this and help to bring about a reconciliation. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, with young students to start working at
yes,
that.
Yes, 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 I think important.
Yeah. One thing I know of is the Southern Poverty Law Center has a whole called Teaching Tolerance. They have videos and, you know, kind of lesson plans, and they send out a publication for teachers. And just from what I've read of that, not having seen it implemented, but when, you know, other people write in, you know, what they've done, simple things like having children sit with different people in the cafeteria to, mm-hmm. you know, interact. And, mm-hmm. So people are attempting it, and I've seen it.
That's good.
I think that's a great thing. Mm-hmm. So anybody who knows, that teachers can get this information free by simply sending a request for the materials to on the school letterhead, the Southern Poverty Law Center, and provide it.
Or there may be some other aspect of Gandhi and what you know about him that you'd rather pursue. I mean,
Well, you had indicated you'd recently in South Africa and learned some things about Gandhi. So I was curious, what did you learn there that you thought was so insightful to you and your understanding?
Well, I think he first encountered the injustice of racism in South Africa. When he was, though he held a first-class ticket on the train, was thrown off the train because he was not a white, and refused to move to the part of the train that was reserved for the for coloreds or for non-whites. That experience was a real awakener for him, I think, and how he then began to struggle with ways in which to deal with the racism of the apartheid movement, and that was so endemic in South African society, was one thing. Another thing, the whole ashram movement began in South Africa with the establishment of two ashrams, experimental communities to deal with this. So he went there as a kind of legal counsel for a British, for an Indian trading group, and ended up as an activist in advocating the rights of the Indian community in there. And so much of what we see in later Gandhi actually began in his South African experience.
Are there other traditions in India that lead to this kind of violent thinking?
I'm sorry.
Any of the other major religions in India, or historical religions, have large components that might be close to what Gandhi believed?
I I don't think he drew much on the Buddhist tradition, though, of course, Buddhism and the Buddha advocated non-violence also, and compassion. I'm not sure where he would have come into contact particularly with the Buddhists, because for many centuries, as you may know, Buddhism was absent from India, the land of its birth, and only recently, within the last 50 to 75 years, has there taken place a renaissance of Buddhism in the land of its birth. But interestingly, with regard to the whole issue of the outcasts, and a man by the name of Dr. Ambedkar, who is one of the authors of the Indian Constitution. And Gandhi and Ambedkar had some very, very serious disagreements with regard to this whole business of caste. And so some aspects attracted Gandhi, and others caused him much grief and turmoil. But I think probably the Hindu tradition and Jain tradition and Christian, particularly Sermon on the Mount and some Christian hymns and so on, are the sort of three religious traditions from which Gandhi that are prevalent in India today, or at his time, that he drew from. Anything else that strikes you, or questions, or?
Is there now in India any kind of following of Gandhi that might help?
Yeah, actually, I've forgotten. We were having a conversation with somebody about the people who get lionized and put on pedestals and so on, as a ending up with their being disregarded. I mean, you set them up as the father of the nation, as Gandhi has done, and then you proceed to ignore him. In many ways, that's the situation I think in India today. Not many people. The Gandhians that I know are mostly people of that generation. Younger people, I think, do not have the film Attenborough's film. I talked to a number of Indians and asked them, how did that make you feel to see all that? And somehow they were not particularly engaged by it. So I don't think that the Gandhian heritage, though he is the father of the nation, is a particularly live heritage in India today. I mean, the government still continues to support hand-woven cloth and so on by subsidizing it, which is, many people would say that's an economic drain on India's resources. I don't know.
I think an area in which Gandhi had a wide variety of concerns which were interlinked, and not so much in the area of nonviolence as currently among environmentalists who are looking for ways to challenge the industrialization and modern technological advances and capitalist globalization and so on, are much appreciative of Gandhi's concern for simple living, for sustainability, for the resources of the planet being distributed widely, and living simply so that others may simply live. Gandhi is quoted frequently in a variety of contexts, but one of his sayings is, the earth provides enough for each one's need, but not for each one's greed.